the headlines, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vows to stay in politics as the parliament is set to vote on a new coalition cabinet that could end his 12-year-long rule. China reacts to G7 leaders' plans to counter its infrastructure scheme, saying the days when small groups of nations decided to the fate of the rest of the world is gone. Russia reports nearly 15,000 new infections from coronavirus, the largest one-day national caseload since February 13. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to stay in politics as he addressed lawmakers ahead of Parliament's vote on a new coalition cabinet. Right-wing Naftali Bennett is expected to become the new Prime Minister if the Knesset gives its vote of confidence to the new cabinet. We are now joined by our correspondent, Mona Kandel, for more details. Mona.
The new Israeli coalition cabinet still faces confidence vote. Good Prime Minister Netanyahu, in conclusion of his speech, he accused and attacked the new coalition, focusing his criticism of Naftali Bennett's Yamin party, and he's saying that also accusing the new coalition of seeking to enact the fascist democratic law against him. Since Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will not accept to leave his office after 12 years of being Israeli Prime Minister, he's trying to continue criticizing this new regime, and trying to convince the Israeli parties not to vote for the Israeli coalition government. However, the other Israeli party members and leaders will have speeches at the same time. At the conclusion of the sitting, the Israeli cabinet will whether they will vote for Bennett cabinet, and then this means the end of Netanyahu's term in office after 12 years. Otherwise, they will go either for a fifth election in more than 2 years, or even trying to form a new coalition and convincing the various Israeli parties. The mission is not easy. Naftali Bennett and Lapid are still facing some difficulties before they could get the last vote, especially that Netanyahu and his supporters in the last few days were holding demonstrations outside the residence of Naftali Bennett and Lapid, saying that they reject toppling down the Likud party. Netanyahu again saying that he would bring again Likud to the power and he will not accept to leave Israeli politics.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent Mona Kandel, live from Ramallah. Moving on, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has reacted to remarks by Foreign Minister of the United Arab Emirates, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan. Hamas spokesman in a tweet said that the remarks made by the top Emirati diplomat are in line with Israeli regime's aspirations and false accounts. Hazem Qasim added that the comments also run counter to approaches and viewpoints of Arab nations supporting the resistance front in occupied Palestine. In his recent remarks, Al-Nahyan expressed regret that some countries have not put movements such as Hamas on their list of terrorist groups. He also expressed hope that the normalization of ties between Abu Dhabi and Tel Aviv would pave the way for other Arab countries to follow suit. Political commentator Mohsen Saleh says the latest remarks by the UAE foreign minister show that the country is acting against Palestinians' right to defend themselves against Israeli atrocities.
So I'm not surprised, actually, of these declarations, of these statements, which indicate to the ignorance and to the unjust words of the about the Palestinian issue and the Palestinian resistance. Instead of helping, instead of trying to condemn the Israeli atrocities against the children and the women and the elderly in Palestine, they condemn the resistance. They are against the right of the Palestinians of defending themselves. And I guess this trend will be defeated. I guess this trend is breathlessly trying to keep its point, its pause in this region. And I guess they are counting their ends.
Moving on, leaders of the Group of Seven developed countries known as the G7 have met in England for a three-day summit. They discussed various issues, including the competition with China, and they unveiled a project to counter a major Chinese infrastructure scheme. That prompted Beijing's reaction. It said a small group of nations should not rule the world. Earlier in our news review, we discussed this topic with our guest. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the news review section. China has cautioned leaders of Group of Seven developed countries that the days when small groups of nations decided the fate of the world are long gone. The Chinese embassy in London underlined that Beijing believes that all countries are equal and that world affairs should be handled through consultation with all states. Now, that reaction was made after G7 leaders in their summit in Carbis Bay in southwest England addressed the strategic competition with China. Leaders from Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the UK, and the US unveiled a project to counter China's trillion-dollar infrastructure scheme called the Belt and Road Initiative. According to officials, the US is pushing other G7 leaders for concrete action against China and to include criticism of Beijing in their final communique from the summit. Let's get some insight on this. I'll be joined by a couple of guests who will have our own side putters in our London bureau. And also, we'll be joined by Angelo Giuliano, political analyst in Montreal. Good to have you both, gentlemen. Now, Saeed, tell us more about this G7 summit. The U.S. playing looks like a pivotal role to push everybody else and set them off against China. And you just heard Chinese reactions. So, what's going on there?
Well, there was this whole Build Back Better World project, also known as the B3W project, is the brainchild of the American administration. Aimed at squarely rivaling China's, as you said earlier, multi-trillion dollar BRI, Belt and Road Initiative, the new Silk Road. U.S. officials would tell you that this is not just about confronting or rivaling or taking on China. Rather, it's about providing the world with an affirmative and positive vision. Whereas, if you know anything about the relations between China and the U.S. This is definitely more about the former than the latter. The American plan clearly has backing among the G7 nations, although not in equal measure. For example, Britain and France are on board, whereas Japan has indicated to be ambivalent in answering the U.S. call for concrete action, as you said, against China. Germany has huge investments in China. It, too, seems to be leaning towards more cooperation rather than confrontation or an adversarial approach. There is also the question of feasibility. According to many, this G7 initiative is very late on arrival. The Chinese initiative, the BRI, has been out there, has existed for 8 years. It is very well developed, and it's already being implemented. There's also the question of financing. Who is going to finance this multi-trillion dollar project that the G7 is promising? Mm-hmm. This is all, let's all remember, happening at a time of the devastation left behind by the pandemic on their economies and the economies around the world. So at the end of the summit today, the U.S. might be able to get the G7 leaders to speak in unison against China, but when it comes to action, we'll have to see how united they're going to be. And that also takes us back to the question that the Chinese have raised. Why not work together at the table? A lot of the people in the know would say that China had to be present. It's a major player. But at the end of the day, this is about the bifurcation in the sphere of influence, the Chinese and the American sphere of influence, with each vying for expanding theirs.
Okay, good point. Now let me ask Angela what he thinks. What is G7's agenda? To divide the world? Why not just, like Said said rightly, Chinese are asking for cooperation? We remember the UN General Assembly meeting, President Trump at that time threatening and calling them names, but instead we had the Chinese president, without calling names, said we're here just to cooperate with the world. Why not just sit down and talk?
I think the G7 are trying to divide the world. You should try to be united. It's not United Front, and it has become very marginal. If you were to look now, in 2020, the largest, the real G7 largest economies, you would have only the US, Japan, and Germany that would be in the top seven. And if you do a projection in 2050, there would be only the US that would be part of the G7, and it would be only in the third position after China and India. So it's becoming more and more irrelevant. It's actually the profile is a profile of countries that have been imperial before. They've been colonized the world, and they're trying to hold onto their empires around the world, in Africa and their influence all around the world. So China here is the voice of the greater south. And of course, China is winning this war, which is on the trading front. And I think we need to look at the real fight. It's not about ideology. It's more about the hegemony, how those countries can hold on to power. And the ultimate fight is on the U.S. dollar. Once the U.S. dollar hegemony will fall, it could be a collapse of the U.S. and indirectly rest of the G7.
Okay, thank you very much for that. That's it for this news review. Let me thank our guests. We had Said Pourreza in London and Angela Giuliana, political analyst, who joined us in Monterey.
Moving on, Russia has reported nearly 15,000 new COVID infections in the past 24 hours. That is the largest one-day caseload there since February 13. Russia's coronavirus task force also said nearly 360 people died of COVID-19 across the country during the same period. That takes the country's total death toll from the pandemic to 126,430. Russian officials are trying to slow the spread of the new wave of the coronavirus. They have ordered workers in the capital, Moscow, to stay off work this coming week. They have also imposed restrictions on many businesses. In France, some marches have been held against the rise of a racist far right and in defense of liberties. Protesters fear the impunity of Islamophobic and racist militias and ask the French government to take popular measures instead of copying far-right topics. Our correspondent from Paris has more.
Against the racist and Islamophobic far-right, in defense of public and individual liberties, that's the main slogan of 140 marches that took place all over France, organized by more than 100 organizations and associations. The protesters say there is an urgency to stop the rise of far-right militias and parties in France that act more and more openly and in full impunity.
It's the first time that we see people producing videos with death threats and using real bullets in a killing setup. We didn't realize the nature of the danger that's rising in our country. The day after the video, the president of the republic's been slapped in the face. I think that now many people are aware of the gravity of the situation.
Earlier this year, thousands of militaries, amongst them dozens of generals, openly called for law and order against the danger of Islamization of the French society. Earlier this week, a known far-right activist posted a video where he steps with a knife and shoots with real bullets a puppet representing progressive activists and calling for the murder of journalists and the left leader Mélenchon. One day later, a far-right activist slapped President Macron in the face, shouting a royalist slogan. But instead of facing a danger of a fascist putsch, the French government was occupied in endless debates in Parliament and Senate about separatism targeting directly the Muslim community or in voting laws protecting the police.
The French government should be a barrier, but step by step it is becoming a bridge to the far right because the government is introducing in the public debate topics like migration and so-called separatism. There is clearly an authoritarian drift of the government, and all these issues pave the way for the far right.
The far right tries to introduce in France as a unique issue the Muslims and the insecurity. These are not the problems that we face. We face social and health problems. These are the real problems.
Protesters say that an authoritarian and racist drift in the French society is already taking place. This ideology is officially carried by the Marine Le Pen party. Instead of facing this danger, they say the French government is copying parts of the far-right program and is not making any concessions to the popular movement like the Yellow Vest protests. Presidential elections will take place in France in less than 1 year, and the odds of a racist and Islamophobic far-right leader taking the reins remain high. Christian Hunt, Paris.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. World Health Organization WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says vaccine inequality between rich and poor countries has created a two-track pandemic. We're prepared to you a news report written jointly by Pushkala Arepaka and Ludwig Berger under the heading EU adds another rare blood condition as side effect of AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine. The news report was published by the Reuters news agency. Europe's drug regulator recently identified another very rare blood condition as a potential side effect of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine and said it was looking into cases of heart inflammation after inoculation with all coronavirus shots. The European Medicines Agency, EMA's safety committee said that capillary leak syndrome, or CLS, must be added to a new side effect to labeling on AstraZeneca's vaccine, known as Vaxzevria. The European Medicines Agency, EMA, added people who had previously sustained the condition, where fluids leak from the smallest blood vessels causing swelling and a drop in blood pressure, should not receive the vaccine shot. The regulator first began looking into these cases in April, and the recommendation adds to AstraZeneca's woes after its vaccine was associated with very rare and potentially lethal cases of blood clotting that come with a low platelet count. Last month, the European Medicines Agency, EMA, had advised against giving a second AstraZeneca shot to people with that clotting condition, known as thrombosis with thrombocytopenia syndrome, or TTS. The committee reviewed 6 validated cases of CLS, or capillary leak syndrome, in people, mostly women, who have received Vaxzevria, including 1 death. 3 had a history of the condition. More than 78 million Vaxzevria doses have been administered in the European Union, in Liechtenstein, in Iceland, in Norway and Britain. In a statement, AstraZeneca pointed out to the extreme rarity of the capillary leak syndrome, or CLS, cases at less than 1 in 10 million vaccinated individuals. Meanwhile, Britain's regulator, the MHRA, said it was considering precautionary advice for people with a history of capillary leak syndrome, or CLS, but does not see a causal link with the vaccine. It said 2 of 8 reports of capillary leak syndrome following AstraZeneca vaccination in the United Kingdom were in people with a history of the condition, and 40 million doses of the vaccine had been given. Separately, the European Medicines Agency, EMA, said it was continuing its probe into cases of heart inflammation known as myocarditis and pericarditis, primarily following inoculation with the Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna mRNA vaccine shots, but also after the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines. U.S. health officials said they had registered a higher-than-expected number of heart inflammation cases in young men who received a second dose of the mRNA vaccine shots, though a causal relationship could not be established as yet. Both Pfizer and Moderna have acknowledged the observations but said a causal association with their vaccines has not been established. BioNTech said adverse events, including myocarditis and pericarditis, are being regularly and thoroughly reviewed by the companies and regulatory authorities. BioNTech claimed more than 300 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine have been administered globally, and the benefit-risk profile of our vaccine remains positive. Meanwhile, the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, said on Thursday, 10th of June, that preliminary findings from 2 vaccine safety monitoring systems suggest a higher-than-expected number of cases of heart inflammation after the second dose of mRNA COVID-19 vaccines in young men. The U.S. Center for Disease Control, CDC, said more than half of the myocarditis or pericarditis cases reported to the U.S. Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System after patients had received either the Pfizer or BioNTech or Moderna vaccines were in people between the ages of 12 and 24. Those age groups accounted for less than 9% of the doses administered. Dr. Tom Shimabukuro, deputy director of the CDC's Immunization Safety Office, said in a presentation to an advisory committee to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration that its meeting on Thursday, we clearly have an imbalance there. Dr. Shimabukuro said that the Vaccine Safety Data Link, or VSD, another safety monitoring system, showed an increased incidence of heart inflammation in 16 to 39-year-olds after their second dose of the vaccine shots when compared to the rate observed after their first dose. Dr. Shimabukuro said that the limited data shows that most of the patients, at least 81% of them, had a full recovery from their symptoms. Pfizer and Moderna were not immediately available for comment. The Center for Disease Control, CDC, said it will hold a meeting of its advisory committee on immunization practices to further evaluate the evidence and assess the risk of myocarditis following mRNA vaccination for COVID-19. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization, WHO's Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said vaccine inequality between rich and poor countries had created a two-track pandemic. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom said in a press conference from Geneva, Switzerland, where the WHO is headquartered on Monday, 8th of June, he said, increasingly, we see a two-track pandemic. 6 months since the first COVID-19 vaccines were administered, high-income countries have administered almost 44% of the world's vaccine doses. Low-income countries, though, have administered just 0.4%. Tedros warned that inequality is a threat to the entire world. The World Health Organization chief, Tedros Ghebreyesus, said the uneven distribution of vaccine among rich and poor nations will not help to end the coronavirus pandemic, adding, inequitable vaccination is a threat to all nations, not just those with the fewest vaccines. And he was not keen only on moral issues, but it's unacceptable because we will not defeat the virus in a divided world. The WHO chief, Tedros, further noted that countries with the highest access to vaccines had had a decline in mortality rates and were planning to ease their restrictions, whereas mortality rates had actually increased in Africa, the Americas, and in the Western Pacific. He also renewed a plea for vaccine donations. A World Health Program for finding, developing, and distributing coronavirus jabs, tests, and therapeutics is short of $3 billion this year, and at least $35 billion is needed next year to immunize all adults around the world. Separately, Oxfam has warned that there is a vaccine apartheid in the world. The United States and the European Union have been accused of hoarding vaccines for their own nationals. The United States has also placed restrictions on COVID-19 vaccine patents, not allowing other nations to access knowledge to produce the vaccine. The World Health Organization, India, and South Africa have called for patents to be temporarily suspended. Even once the ban on patents is lifted, it will take up to a year for a factory to start producing vaccines due to the time needed for technology transfer and the training of the workforce. That situation may not be eased if rich countries unlock their supplies of vaccines. According to Agence France-Presse statistics, the United States and the United Kingdom have received more than half of the 680 million plus doses administered worldwide. The International Rescue Committee, or IRC, has reported that the United States, the United Kingdom, and the European Union pre-purchased enough COVID-19 vaccine doses to vaccinate their populations more than twice over. However, the unequal distribution of vaccines around the world has reportedly pushed the World Health Organization to send COVID-19 vaccines that have reached the end of their expiry dates to African countries. Meanwhile, the Islamic Republic of Iran has developed its own COVID-19 vaccines. One jab, Coviran Barakat, is set to receive emergency use permission and will be rolled out as Iran's first indigenously developed vaccine, having passed its third and final clinical trial. Sobirana 02 vaccine, jointly developed by Iran and Cuba, has also completed its third clinical trial and is now ready for industrial-level production.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we went beneath the world's oceans to discover what has happened to the millions of tons of chemical weapons that have been dumped in the sea since the early 20th century. Now, as we have entered the 21st century and forgotten the days of the war, real time bombs are ticking under the seas of the planet. The Baltic Sea, the most polluted sea in the world, is rife with tons of highly toxic and explosive cocktails of chemical weapons inherited from two world wars, which threaten us today. Stay with us for the second part of the documentary as we go across the Atlantic to see the legacy of two world wars all around the United States coast.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing the fishes are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases both in Denmark but also elsewhere in the world where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
We're in Lahnfurt, Germany. This is where the pipeline comes out of the Baltic Sea, and this is where the gas enters the European gas grid. The munitions issue meant that we had to do extensive detailed surveys. Once the alignments of the pipelines were defined, we then did the detailed munitions surveys. We did very high-resolution side-scan sonar surveys, magnetometer surveys, and bathymetric surveys. And then within the installation corridor, so that's where the pipeline could touch the seabed, we did gradiometer survey works and visual inspections. And out of those, we identified over 400 munitions along the pipeline route. To allow us to have a safe corridor, we had to clear munitions within plus or minus 25 meters of the Nord Stream pipelines. So prior to the installation, we cleared munitions through using detonation techniques in the Gulf of Finland and in Russia. And in Germany, we lifted the munitions that we found close to the route. We had located a number of chemical munitions, and these were avoided.
The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on a investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites, or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't have any idea where they would be.
In the wake of Bull's investigations, the U.S. Congress called upon the Army to increase its efforts to locate dump sites. That work goes on today at the very facility where the U.S. produced its massive chemical weapons arsenal.
My work here has been mostly archival research on when we started, why we started, where we started dumping chemical munitions. White binders are pretty much all of the information that in the last 5 years we've been able to find on the chemical weapons disposals and some conventional in U.S. waters. It is putting a puzzle together in many, many instances because you find a piece of correspondence, say, that Edgewood's got some 4.2 white phosphorus rounds and some 4.2-inch mustard-filled rounds. We need to dispose of them. They are unsafe, unserviceable. They cannot be reconditioned. So you've got that piece of paper. Okay. But all of a sudden you'll get a piece of paper out of Norfolk Navy. I go, wait a minute, now I know what they did with them. And, whoa, we've got the boat. So we go and we find the logbook. And hopefully the captain put in the lat longs. You know, how long did it take him and when he went back to shore? Anytime that you find something that matches up. It's like, I can only equate it maybe to a jigsaw puzzle with 10,000 pieces. How long would that take you to put together? I don't know. Don't want to find out.
William Brankovitz was the first to chart U.S. chemical weapons dumping at foreign and domestic sites for the U.S. Defense Department in the 1980s.
Part of the problem at the end of the war was we captured a great number of those chemical weapons, as did the Russians. And we all share some of that legacy today. Some of those chemical weapons were returned to the United States for exploitation to be looked at and to be evaluated and tested. But the rest of it was, again, thought to be excess to anyone's needs. So a great many of those chemical weapons were taken out to sea and were sea disposed at the time. That pretty much continued right into the 1960s. And in the 1960s, people became concerned about, is this really the way to get rid of chemical weapons? There were a series of chemical weapons disposals that were planned at the end of the 1960s in an operation called Operation Chase. The last one was under a great deal of controversy. By that time, everyone had started to realize that there were potential problems. And so the Army asked the National Academy of Sciences in 1969 to take a look at this problem and do a study and see what the best way was of doing this disposal action. They issued it, and it basically said, due to the fact that we don't know completely how the fate of this material is resolved on the ocean floor, we recommend that you stop sea disposing of chemical weapons. And we moved away at that point in time completely from ocean disposal of chemical weapons. I think about 2 years later, in 1972, there was a congressional act that made it illegal.
The Pentagon began a pilot program to study environmental effects off the coast of Hawaii, where it dumped tons of conventional and chemical munitions over the decades.
I think we've all learned things, that the ocean is not a garbage dump. And if you dump something into the ocean, it does have environmental effects. When you understand that, today we're taking a look to see what those effects are. We're looking at the fish. We're looking at the other biota in the sea to see what effect it has had to determine whether removal is an appropriate course of action. What is down there has been down there 30, 40, 50 or more years. In some cases, 80 years. There's a lot of work the environment has done on these munitions, and that work has been to slowly dissolve them and absorb them. And when we're not finding an adverse impact to health, life, safety, leave in place is continuing to be the right solution. I'm not saying that we won't find a location where we make a different decision. But when we're using a science-based approach, we really want there to be an understanding of the effect on the environment, an understanding on the effect on people, and an understanding of what happens when we bring it up out of the water. Is that really the safest, most risk-averse manner of handling this?
The United States and Great Britain have extended official secrecy until 2017. And for the last 60 years, scientific research on chemical weapons in the sea and the dangers they pose has been limited because of this military control. Canada launched a big effort to dispose of chemical weapons during World War II. One retired Army mine clearing expert has combined environmental concern with an entrepreneurial approach and become a crusader for cleanup.
I'm Wendy Bergfeld, and this is Bain Street. And on today's program, a conversation with Terry Long, a former military engineer, an explosive ordnance disposal expert, more than 30 years experience, and he is sounding the alarm. Our conversation on today's edition of Main Street.
I was born in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and I grew up here. Cape Breton Island is an island. We have a big lake in the middle of it called the Bedore Lakes. It's a very beautiful island, pristine in some areas. When you start looking at in the Badura Lakes, there's actually five munition sites, and one is a chemical weapons disposal site from after the Second World War. Johnstown was used for a chemical weapons facility. Everything was secret. They didn't want people to know that this was actually being manufactured here. It was the same thing after the war when they started to look at decommissioning. It was basically just tear down the structures and leave it. And there was, again, no knowledge that it was a chemical weapons site, so nobody would suspect anything there at all. So when I started looking at that, I started feeling compelled that I had to do something to protect our lake. And then when I started looking outside of Nova Scotia, again, I was getting shocked. All these different munition sites all along the eastern seaboard, all along the west coast of Canada, and all around the world, from the Baltic Sea to the Sea of Japan. The first thing I did is I did a Canadian Senate hearing, and I took the First Nations of Wagobok with me so we could actually talk about it from the perspective of First Nations, as them being the keeper of Mother Earth. So at the Senate hearing, we discussed the different sites, what some of the contaminants are. Two recommendations came out. The first was the United Nations should have an international conference to address sea dump munitions. The second was is we needed to develop a stakeholders group that encompassed everybody to actually look at the effects from the munitions. So what happened is because there was no international conference, I developed the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions, and that became the International Platform for Munitions.
My name is Albert Marshall, and I am from the Moose Clan. I am from Mi'kma'ki, the Mi'kmaq territory, back during the war. We used to see these planes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of bombs dumped into the Badura Lakes. Harry Long informed me of what compounds that these bombs had, because in a lot of our observations, we used to see a lot of unusual lesions in some of these aquatic life. Personally, I've had 6-7 members of my immediate family that have died from various strains of cancer. And even as we speak, I have a granddaughter at the Children's Hospital in Halifax with cancer. Badura Lakes has been a lifeline for our people for so long. Factoring our 7 generations, we have to also ensure that our future generations will also have the same privileges as we have today.
Canadian authorities had never admitted that chemical weapons were dumped in the Badura Lakes, but they haven't denied it either, and for Terry Long, that silence speaks volumes. Concerns that dump sites cannot be cleaned up without injury to humans and damage to the environment has hindered such efforts. But Japanese officials, pushed by economic interests, decided to move ahead. They founded the first industrial program to clean up chemical weapons in the seas. Imperial Japan produced large quantities of weapons containing mustard gas and lewisite in the 1930s. They used them against civilians during the invasion of Manchuria in 1937, killing thousands. Poison gases were produced at Okunoshima Island. The work was so secret the island was removed from Japanese maps during World War II. Today the island is called Bunny Island. The bombs in the Kanda port lie just 10 meters deep, and the Japanese government negotiated a contract with Kobelco, a giant steel corporation, to clear the weapons and destroy them. Kobelco technology is beginning to interest other countries like the United States, Belgium, and France. The Kanda experience and Kobelco's cutting-edge research with underwater robotics demonstrates safe cleanups can be conducted in depths of up to 150 meters safely for humans and the environment. 1 million tons of chemical weapons lie in the depths of the seas. Some have been there for more than 70 years now. Most countries clearly don't want to take responsibility for cleaning up their own weapons, and many other munitions belong to no country. For example, who will pay for the weapons made by Germany during World War II and dumped by the Allies? The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which won the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize, has a mandate to end the spread of chemical weapons around the globe. Since 1992, 190 countries have signed the convention prohibiting chemical weapons. However, the OPCW has never taken a stance on the issue of munitions dumped in the sea. Terry Long, with the support of Baltic state officials, brought his group and the problem to The Hague last spring to urge the organization to support cleanup efforts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody here today to this side event at the LIPA room. My name is Terence Patrick Long. I'm the chairman of the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions. What is desperately needed is ownership and leadership and the coordination of international efforts to adequately address sea-dumped chemical munitions.
We think that time is really ripe to act because weapons are surfacing and calling for action. We are truly convinced that the member state of the OPCW will finally listen to us.
Every now and then people are asking us, is the leakage increasing or not, or is the environmental damage ongoing? We cannot answer them with the degree of certainty we would like to have.
The worldwide dumping of sea-dumped chemical munitions by the international community was a mistake. We all seriously need to accept the obvious, that substances that are too toxic to touch with the ungloved hand has no place in our marine environment.
It's urgent that scientists be free to continue their research. The military secrecy imposed by the Allies since the Potsdam Conference in 1945 must be lifted. This is essential to effectively evaluate the risks these weapons pose to man, the environment, and the food chain.
That the states involved in creating this disaster will finally clean up and take responsibility for their previous actions before it is too late and the legacy of the world wars takes its toll on the world's next generation. Let's wait and see. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.